We are in 2 Kings chapter 5 today, for those of you who are following along. We are in the life of Elisha and what he's been doing for the last few chapters in 2 Kings. We're continuing on in his story and learning more about him and what in the ways which he represents Messiah at various times. And today we'll be discussing 2 Kings chapter 5. Open up with a prayer if you don't mind. Almighty God, our great Heavenly Father, we ask your blessing upon this study, this discussion today, as we learn your ways as best we can and apply it to our lives as we understand them. Please guard us from evil, Father, and teach us well, that we teach our children. In Yeshua's name we pray. Amen. This is 2 Kings chapter 5. Naaman, the commander of the army of the king of Aram, was an eminent man before his master and well honored. For through him had the Lord granted victory to Aram. The man was a great warrior, a leper. Aram had gone out in raiding parties and had captured a young girl from the land of Israel. She was serving before Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "The prayers of my master should be brought before the prophet who is in Samaria. Then he will heal him from his leprosy." So Naaman went and told his master, saying, Naaman went to his master and told him, saying, "Such and such spoke the girl, who is from the land of Israel." The king of Aram said, "Go and approach him, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel." He went and took in his hand 10 talents of silver, 6,000 pieces of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. He brought to the king of Israel the letter which said, "And now, when this letter reaches you, behold, I have sent my servant Naaman to you, that you should heal him from his leprosy." When the king of Israel read the letter, he rent his garments and said, "Am I God that I can take and give life? This person sends me instructions to heal a man of his leprosy? Understand and realize that he speaks a pretext against me." When Elisha, the man of God, heard the king of Israel had rent his garments, he sent word to the king, saying, "Why did you rend your garments? Let him come to me now, and he will realize there is a prophet in Israel." Naaman came with his horses and his chariot and stood at the entrance of Elisha's house. Elisha sent a messenger out, saying, "Go, bathe 7 times in the Jordan River. Your flesh will become normal again, and you will be clean." Naaman was enraged and left. He said, "Behold, I said to myself that he would surely come out to me and stand and call the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the diseased area, and the leper would be healed. Are not Amana and Pharpah, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Do I not always bathe in them? Have I become cleansed?" Then he turned and went in a fury. But his servants approached and spoke to him and said, "My father, had the prophet told you to do a difficult thing, would you not have done it? How much more so now that he has told you, bathe and become cleansed?" So he went down and immersed himself 7 times in the Jordan River, in accordance with the word of the man of God. And his flesh became like the flesh of a young boy. And he became cleansed. He returned to the man of God, he and his entire retinue. He arrived and stood before him and said, "Behold, now I know there is no God in the whole world except in Israel. And now please accept a tribute from your servant." Elisha answered, "As the Lord lives, whom I stood lives, I swear I will not accept." He urged him to accept, but he refused. Naaman said, "At least let there be given to your servant a mule's team's load of earth, for your servant will never again offer an elevation offering to any or any sacrifice to any other gods, but only to the Lord. May the Lord forgive your servant this one thing, however. When my master comes to the temple of Ramon to bow down there, he leans on my arm, so I must bow down in the temple of Ramon. When I bowed down the temple of Ramon, may the Lord forgive your servant for this thing." Elisha said to him, "Go in peace. And Naaman traveled a short distance from him. Gehazi, the attendant of Elisha, the man of God, said to himself, "Behold, my master has spared this Aramean, Naaman, by not accepting from his hand what he had brought. As the Lord lives, I swear that I shall run after him and take something from him." So Gehazi chased after Naaman. Naaman saw him running after him, and he alighted from the chariot to greet him and said, "Is all well?" He said, "All is well. My master sent me, saying, 'Just now, two young men of the prophets and disciples have arrived to me from the Mount Ephraim. Please give them a talent of silver and two changes of clothing.'" Naaman said, "Please, take two talents." He prevailed upon him, and he wrapped up two talents of silver in two pouches, and took two changes of clothing, and gave it to his two attendants, who carried it before Gehazi. When they came to a secluded place, Gehazi took it from their hands and hid it in his house. He then sent off the men, and they went. Then he came and stood before his master. Elisha said to him, "Where are you coming from, Gehazi?" He said, "Your servant did not go here or there." Elisha then said to him, "Did my heart not go along also, when a man turned aside from upon his chariot to greet you? Is this a proper time to accept money with which to buy clothing, olive trees, vineyards, sheep, cattle, slaves, and maidservants? Naaman's leprosy shall therefore cleave to you and to your children forever." When Gehazi left his presence, he was white as snow with leprosy. The story of 2 Kings chapter 5. Before I get to my little spiel about it and talk about it, details of what I see in the story, are there any questions or comments or things that got your attention in this particular story regarding Naaman and how he was healed? Now, of course, you recall Messiah references this in the book of Luke, I think it is, references this healing from Naaman and how that relates to Messiah, which we'll talk about that as we get there. Any comments, things you didn't like or heard and said, "Wait a minute, why did you do that?" Seven times river, yeah? Mount Ephraim. It's a place.
Well, I think the servant also went beyond what he was supposed to do. He accepted...
That's much beyond. Yes, Gehazi did do something he was essentially instructed through example not to do. And he purposely did opposite. Yes?
If a priest rents his clothes, does that disqualify him as a priest?
The priest didn't rip his clothes, the king did. But we're going to discuss that. That's a very significant part of the story and why it's in here. It's what the king did.
This story sounds similar to the one you had last time, right?
This is a continuation of the story last time. Last time, it was in chapter 4. It had discussed, for the most part, you know, the examples of what he did. You know, we bring the boy back to life, and there was the deadly stew was fixed. These are that which were a series of miracles that Elisha accomplished, and we related them to Elijah as well as to Messiah last time, discussing how not perfectly, but how they mapped one another, so you could recognize a purpose, of course, to recognize Messiah when he showed up. We'd say, okay, well, these men were acting like him. If somebody shows up that acts like these men are acting, thus, that's the Messiah. It's an identifier.
So would it be fair to say that people with leprosy would be of that mind?
Would be healed? No, I don't think that's a fair assessment. To argue that, it's a good question, it's a fair question.
Yeah.
Whether or not the curse from Elisha upon Gehazi and all of his subsequent children would be, you know, the source or a continued problem for all eternity. I won't say for certain, no, but leprosy existed prior to this, and many people had it, and by the time Messiah showed up, many, many more people had it. Hansen's disease, that's what it's called today, if I remember correctly. It's still, I can't remember if it's a bacteria or viral. I can't remember what the details, I've forgotten. It might be bacterial, but it's an infection, and we're going to discuss a little bit in Leviticus when it discusses the details of the infection and what this leprosy is. The Bible is very specific in that leprosy is a generic term, and the Bible's very important to not specify strictly leprosy. The way the definition is given in the Torah, it can include what we would call a severe case of eczema, or psoriasis is also categorized in the same grouping. It is a skin disease that's usually a little bit, sometimes much, deeper than just the surface of the skin. And those are examples that which are skin diseases, but they can go deeper as well. Leprosy happens to have a raw flesh association to it as well, which a lot of bleeding and things and other problems, but that's also included. They're all basic the same type of category. Not the same disease, but the same category as far as Leviticus is concerned. The same grouping. So you treat them all the same way. Any comments or questions regarding that? Or other stuff that got your attention?
I thought the flesh.
Leprosy dissolves it. It eats away and kills it off. It literally just takes off chunks. It consumes it to where it dies. Yeah, there's flesh-eating diseases and other things too, which we're not going to go into all the details of every medical disease there is. I'm not a physician. Any other comments, though, regarding this? Okay. Yeah, I'm going to go straight to where because I'm short on time already. I didn't even barely even started. Starting in verse 1, we begin. It says, Naaman, the commander army of Kiram, was eminent, well-honored. It says, for through him the Lord granted victory to Aram. Now, Aram is another name for Syria, we call it today. Damascus would be in charge of it. We're familiar with basic Syria and where it is geographically. We don't know for certain what victory the Lord granted to Syria that's being referred to here, but note that as far as the writer of 2 Kings is concerned, they noted that this victory, whatever victory it was to Naaman, was given to them by God. The only victory that we know about by records that happened in Naaman's lifetime, the first victory, I should say, was a victory over a very bad Israelite king. Anybody recall his name? Ahab. Ahab was the most prominent king that Amam was able to kill off. The Jewish tradition places the person who pulled the bowstring, the random shot, was Naaman. But no one knows for certain. It's just a tradition that he was one who happened to randomly shoot and happened to hit the king Ahab and, of course, killed him. But the point is that whatever the details, whatever great commander this man was, God gave it to him, and God usually, I won't say always, but usually when he's dealing with an army or a military, giving benefit or giving help in them or for them, it's to correct or squash somebody else. Typically, it's been pretty consistent. He doesn't usually deviate from the path, that pattern to use people against each other. And God very clearly went against the house of Ahab in Naaman's recent lifetime. So it could be. So, of course, there's raiding parties, there's slaves going back and forth. It may cause some strangeness as to why is it that two opposing countries who hate one another would send delegations back and forth while there's raiding parties going back and forth at the same time on the sidelines without fear of the commander Naaman being captured or killed or whatever, because clearly he's a relatively high prize if he's a commander of Syria's army. But obviously Israel didn't care so much, or the king of Israel didn't care so much. What I want to bring to your attention, it was verse 3. The slave girl says to him, just, the prayers of my master, she brought before the prophet who's in Samaria, and he will heal him of his leprosy. Now, what did the slave girl recognize with Naaman? What was that? Faith? That's true. He believed in something, whatever it was. He believed in something. Now, put yourself in his shoes for a moment. You have this horrible skin disease, and you can't get rid of it. You're trying to get rid of it. How many people have you talked to probably by now? Everybody. What physicians have you seen? All of them. What attempts have you done to this herb and that herb and this thing and that thing? What have you not tried? Probably nothing that you can possibly find. He's tried, as far as most likely, since he's dealing with this issue, everything. Now, this particular issue, which I find interesting, we don't know the extent of what leprosy it actually was, and that his king was not concerned about it when he went into the temple run with him and held on to his arm to kneel down. It brings attention because normally when there's a leper, what did this culture do to lepers? You get away. Why? It's contagious. They don't want other people to get it. This king clearly was not concerned about getting it from his commander. So we don't know if it was actually what we would classify today as leprosy, the contagious disease, as opposed to some other skin-related disease. That's why the commentary is, though it says leprosy, the word choice, says leprosy, it's actually tzara, which is just an unclean skin disease. Don't know what it actually is. But the king wasn't worried about it being contagious. So continuing on, the girl recognized something in Naaman. He was obviously praying probably to the temple of Ramon like his king does and probably every other god they'd possibly find in Damascus or in Syrian capital area in general. Probably prayed to everyone. Did she say he should go try some herbal concoction? No. Did she go try some physician? Did she actually say go and bow before another king or another god? She didn't. She didn't even tell him, go pray to the God of Israel, did she? Well, why not? She's Israelite, right? She knows who God is, right? Clearly she identified as a prophet. She knows who he is. She didn't say, Naaman, you're my master, you're worshiping the wrong God, go to this God over here. She said, bring your prayers to the prophet over there. Yes, Sean.
Semblance to the children of Israel, they saw Aaron and Moses, so they give credit to the men, not to God.
Right, they do. Now, this is very important, though, in this instance, because she's doing something, and she made a statement, whether she knew it or not, I don't care. She made a statement that is very key to understand the rest of the chapter. And then what she did, she identified the prophet Elisha as the one to go to, as opposed to the God of Israel to go to, or the high priest in Jerusalem to go to. She identified the prophet Elisha was the one to go to, and your prayer she brought to the man, Elisha. Noted that. It's very important to see what she did. Whether she knew it or not, that's what she did. We're going to discuss why she did it. Well, again, she may not have known why, but why the Bible records this way it's done, because it's important to us. So, of course, he goes, he talks to his king, says, may I please go? Of course, goes, so he goes. All right, brings all this stuff with him. We're not going to all the details, all the stuff he brought. He goes to the king of Israel. Before we go there, let's go immediately to Leviticus chapter 13. For a normal individual now in Israelite territory, Leviticus chapter 13, there are rules, instructions given. And only the priest is to do these things, not Elisha. We're not going to read the entire chapter. It's very lengthy. So, it's a very lengthy chapter discussing all forms of human skin diseases and problems that the priest is supposed to examine and things of that nature. We'll give you a few samplings here and there. Starting out in verse 1 of chapter 13 of the book of Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 13, verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, when a man has on the skin of his body a swelling, a scab, or bright spot, becomes on the skin of his body like a leprous sore, he should be brought before Aaron the priest, or to one of his sons the priests. The priest should look at the sore on the skin of the body, and if the hair of the sore is turned white, the sore appears to be deep in the skin of his body, is a leprous sore. The priest shall look at him and pronounce him unclean. If the bright spot of white of the skin of his body does not appear to be deeper than the skin, the hair is not turned white, the priest shall isolate the one who is sore for 7 days. The priest shall look at him on the seventh day, and indeed if the sore appears to be as it was, the sore is not spread in the skin, the priest shall isolate him another 7 days. The priest shall look at him again on the seventh day, and indeed if the sore is darkened and the sore is not spread, then the priest shall pronounce him clean. It's only a scab. And he shall wash his clothes and be clean. But if the scab should at all spread over the skin after he has been seen by the priest for his cleansing, he should be seen by the priest again. If the priest sees the scab has indeed spread the skin, the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It is leprosy. Now, it continues on, verse 9. Leprosy, details of how you find it and how you deal with it. We'll drop down to verse 44 of chapter 13. This is regarding a leprous man on his body. In this case, the leprosy, of course, is on Naaman's body. As leprous man, he is unclean. The priest shall surely pronounce the man unclean because of the sore, in this case, his head. Same difference of his body. Now, in verse 45, the leper on whom the sore is, his clothes shall be torn, his head shaved bare, and he shall cover his mustache and cry, unclean, unclean. And he shall be unclean all the days he has the sore. He shall be unclean. He is unclean, and he shall dwell alone. His habitation shall be outside the camp of Israel. That's how you deal with a normal leprous person. So when Naaman from Syria is sent over to Israel, what's Israel's immediate instruction to do? Bring him to the priest. Priest examine him. Obviously, time goes by. The examination takes time. What is determined leprous, or somehow it's contagious, whatever it may be. The Naaman would have his head shaved if it was on his head. Would have his body shaved if it was on his body. Discuss the other areas with shaved beards or whatever it may be. And he would have his face covered and yell unclean. His horse clothes would be ripped apart, his face covered. He would have to be the one who yells, not the priest, but the man who has leprosy on him, unclean, unclean, unclean. Did any of that happen to Naaman? No. No. It says that the one to whom, said, on whom the sore is, his clothes. Oh, the king. The king ripped his clothes.
Yeah, right.
That's where I'm heading. The king rips his clothes in Israel. We'll discuss that shortly. That's where I'm going to. In the case of Naaman, his clothes didn't get ripped. He has actually 10 sets of new clothes, which is great. Lots of gold and silver to go with it. Horses, servants, whatever else he has. The whole lot of things. Was he shaved? Did any of this stuff happen to him? Was it to be analyzing him, examining him, looking at him? No, none of this stuff happened. Why not? There's no priest in Israel. He's not even Israelite, right? So what does it matter? Well, he's not Israelite. That means Israel should invite all the leprous people, the whole world, because the laws don't apply to them. It only applies to people of Israel, right? Examining Naaman wasn't the point. Naaman wasn't supposed to be examined. Who was being examined? Who was found unclean? Well, it says quite plainly in verse 7, when the king of Israel read the letter, he rent his garments. The king of Israel did. He said, am I God? I take and give life. This one sends me instruction to heal him of his leprosy. I was going to realize that he seeks a pretext, which means he seeks an objective or a reason to go against him, i.e. for war. That's the objective, to go to war against him. So what did the king then realize? Paranoia. He's the one being examined. Who got the clothes torn? The king's. What was the king's supposed fate now? He's going to be killed, going to war. He has a war ahead of him. This is destruction, the loss of his kingdom. No, this is a relatively new king, not like as in brand new. He's been there for a couple of years, but not too often. He's one of Ahab's sons, the second son. So this king is the one being examined. And what did Elisha respond with? Why did you rent your clothes? Why did the king tear his clothes? Well, according to the instructions of Leviticus, symbolically, the one who tears his clothes is the one that's found being leprous, diseased, worthless, or needs to be removed out and gotten rid of. That's what the instructions in Leviticus tell us. So the symbolism going on here that we're reading in Kings is the king is being evaluated, the king of Israel, being evaluated. And what's he found? The king sees nothing but doom in his future. What does a leprous man find? Well, he sees nothing but isolation and doom in his own personal future. Do you see the point? The symbolism we're given in 2 Kings is a symbolism given in Leviticus, but it's being applied to different people. All the elements are there, but who it's being applied to is being rearranged for us. So we can see something about the king of Israel this time. What we're seeing is we're seeing the king has been evaluating, or is being evaluated, by this sequence of leprosy. The king is obviously not physically leprous, but morally or biblically or God's eyes leprous. So he responds, of course, Elisha responds, "Don't, why'd you rent your clothes, king? Send them to me and I'll heal him." So Elisha points out to the king, who is being examined as far as we're concerned, as far as the Second Kings is concerned, being examined, that he's the one who examined. He felt that obviously his fate is now doomed. He has been determined that he is of no value or worthless. It's symbolism, of course, only. And the man, of course, who actually is having trouble is sent to Elisha for saving, for helping. When Naaman arrives at Elisha's house, and of course goes there, and Elisha sends a servant out to tell him what to do, what is Naaman's immediate response? This is also tied to the king of Israel shortly. We'll discuss that in a minute. What's his immediate response? Offense, anger. What was Naaman looking for? Possibly honor. What else was he looking for? What did he say he was looking for? "Behold," is verse 11, "I said to myself, he would surely come out to me and stand and call the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the diseased area, and the leper would be healed. But not the waters of Bedar in Damascus." What was he expecting? He was expecting the man to come out, obviously to look at him, wave his hand over, you know, do some magic trick to make the leprosy go away. That's what he was wanting. Those of us who have suffered from skin diseases, I'm one of them, how much would we love that? Please, go away. We have this, that's what we would love that. Why? Because Naaman has spent probably years battling this skin disease, whatever it may be. A lot of money probably done it too. And he's willing to pay for it. Obviously a lot of money with him. To pay to get rid of this problem. To fix it for him. Was it fixed that way? No, it wasn't. So of course he goes, obviously he storms off. His servants say, "Go dip 7 times. He of course agrees to do so. When he returns and sees that his body's healed, obviously, then he returns. What does Naaman now understand differently about the God of Israel? Because nobody else can do it. Nobody else can do that. But what would be the difference if Elisha had just waved his hand over it and fixed it? Possibly the Elisha got in glory. Naaman recognized that the Jordan River is not a very good river. It's just a river. It's got people upstream that do things in it, and there's pollution going downstream toward the Dead Sea. It's not, there's nothing good about it. It's just a river. Does he think God's in the river? No. Does he think the river can save him? No, clearly he's bathed many times in cleaner water and it didn't work. So he knows it's not a dirt thing that your infection just wash it off and goes away. His actions. He recognized something. Wait a minute. A thing didn't do it. A silly action that shouldn't do anything at all. He followed, yep. Which is what the little girl, or the slave girl, recognized in Naaman. He has a belief that his problem wasn't a medical, go to a doctor, go to a physician. He realized, or understood, at least at this point in his life, that his solution wasn't in a medicinal problem. It wasn't a medicinal fix, or a dietary fix, or whatever it may be. It required something outside that. So the little bit of faith that the slave girl recognized in Naaman, her comments allowed that to grow, bringing Naaman, obviously, to the king of Israel. How much faith does the king of Israel have? Big fat zip. We already found that out in previous chapters. He doesn't have any faith in the God of Israelite God at all. So he has nothing. We'll discuss him shortly again in a minute. But Naaman had a little bit. Naaman obviously was angry. his servant said, go dip anyway. The small amount of faith he had then grew. But of course, it's a great story. It all makes us feel good that he got all better and now he's happy again. We're going to go somewhere else in a moment regarding this particular topic. Because this topic is not isolated. 2 Kings chapter 5. Messiah does this differently, though, which is a little more insight to Naaman and why the story is here. Because the story isn't here just for the fun of it. Oh, look, another guy got healed. Oh, how wonderful is that? If God does it all the time, move on. It's not about that. It's about something the Messiah was supposed to do and tried to point out in his lifetime, which we're going to get to. Before Naaman leaves, of course, he says, okay, I realize there's only one God now. Rimmon is a worthless thing. Which, again, is also indicative of Messiah. We'll talk about that again in a moment. But he still has his job to do, to kneel down with the king, yada, yada, yada. We won't go into the details of that at this point, as far as what he should or shouldn't do, whatever. Let's go to Luke chapter 4. Excuse me. This is Luke chapter 4, verse... Yes, well, I don't need the whole section. I read this once before. We'll go to verse 24. It starts at verse 24, discussing a section that Messiah is talking about and early on in his ministry as far as being rejected as a prophet. Because note, did the king of Israel trust or believe in Elisha at all? Not particularly. Although he said, hey, take them on. You got something, go ahead and help him if you can. But the king of Israel did not worship with or even understand or care about the true God of Israel. The Messiah said, this is verse 24 of chapter 4 in the book of Luke. The Messiah said, assuredly I say to you, no prophet is accepted in his own country. But I tell you truly, many widows were in Israel the days of Elijah, when the heavens were shut up for 3 years, 6 months, and there was a great famine throughout the land. But none of them was Elijah sent to, except Zarephath in the region of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow. And many lepers were in Israel in the time of Elisha, the prophet, and none of them was cleansed except Naaman the Syrian. What was Messiah's point in that? What is the similarities between the widow in Sidon and Naaman the Syrian? What's the main similarity between them? Were either of them Israelite? No. Right. They did obey the prophet. They didn't know what he was doing or why he was doing it, but they did anyway. So, the similarities, which we're going to get to again in chapter, also book of Luke, chapter 17, there's a similar story. Yes, Ellie.
What it was like to not have God. When you don't have God and then you run into the real God, it strikes true, but if you've had it, sometimes you become so accustomed to it that it ceases to be important.
That's true. It does cease to be important. As he points out, a prophet is not accepted in his own country. God was not accepted in his own country. Elisha was not accepted in his own country. Jesus was not accepted in his own country. They didn't believe him. Didn't trust him. But somebody else who was not from there did. Go to Luke chapter 17. Luke chapter 17, verse 11. Now it happened as he went to Jerusalem that he passed through the midst of Samaria and Galilee. Then as he entered a certain village, there he met 10 men who were lepers, who stood afar off. Now, that's correct. They're supposed to stand away from people who are healthy. Verse 13. And they lifted their voices and said, Jesus, Master, have mercy on us. So when he saw them, he said, go, show yourselves to the priests. And so it was, as they went, they were cleansed. Now, one of them, when he saw that he was healed, returned and with a loud voice glorified God, fell down on his face at his feet, giving him thanks, and he was a Samaritan. Jesus answered and said, were there not 10 cleansed? But where are the 9? Were there not any found who returned to give glory to God except this foreigner? He said to him, arise, go your way. Your faith has made you well. What was Messiah's instructions to the 10 men? The priests. What's the rule? Are they supposed to do that? Absolutely, to be examined. The priest is supposed to examine all lepers and determine whether you be kicked out or not. So after you're kicked out for isolation for a period of time, you can voluntarily ask to be re-examined. Hey, I think it's gotten better. Please take a look. That's normal. Most of you would go to a modern-day physician. I have an owie. Oh, look at it. Okay, owie's bad. A week later, hey, look, it's better. Is it good? Oh, yeah, okay, good. Now we're all good. Go on your way. Here's your bill. That's pretty how that would work in modern day. Not much different in Israelites' time. It's fine. Nothing wrong with that. What priests did they go to? One of them went to the Messiah to be examined. Did you notice that? He sent 10 off to go to the priests. So as they're traveling, one of them takes a U-turn and travels to the priest. Who's the priest he went to? The great high priest Messiah. And he said, were there not 10 of you who were cleansed? Meaning Messiah examined and saw, you are cleansed. Were there not 10, there's where's the 9, yada, yada, yada. Goes the story. And then Messiah said, go your way, not go back to the priest to be re-examined. Meaning you've been examined. I just examined you. You're fine. Go on. Faith has healed him. So in Naaman's case, which is the exact same story, almost exact same story, he comes to, quote, the priest, end of quote, who is Elisha. He says, heal me, Elisha. Elisha says, go, dip 7 times. And the man's healed. Now, Elisha didn't say, come back. But he came back anyway. And who did he give glory to? God. Naaman gave glory to God right at that moment, just like this man did, the foreigner. The outsider, the one who's not part of Israel, recognized him. Now, Naaman now recognized there is one God in Israel, one God in the whole world, and that's it. He was a foreigner, not part of Israel at all. The Samaritan in Messiah's time did the exact same thing. There's no difference, really. He goes, sees he is now clean, and he returns to glorify God and verify, obviously, Messiah can see that he's been cleansed. So the story in Elisha with Naaman, the purpose of it was that it brings the character of Elisha in a similar position as the character of Messiah. And that a foreigner comes over, becomes cleansed, and gives glory to God in the presence and right before that particular man who is responsible for healing him. So the foreigner then elevated up the messianic figure, Elisha. In the Naaman story. In this case, Messiah's story in Luke, the foreigner elevated up Messiah in the high priest's position. A foreigner did. Someone who is outside of Israel recognized who Messiah or who Elisha was. That they are the, quote, priest, end quote. They're the messengers of God, the evaluators of God in God's eyes. It's strictly symbolic, but that's the objective of the symbolism, to see connections between them. Yes, Sean.
What I'm finding interesting, though, twice, verse 11 and 12, he's furious and then he's enraged.
Yes.
So he finally says bind, then he goes and dips.
Yes.
And he's still made whole, even though his attitude wasn't correct.
His attitude wasn't good, because his faith was very little.
But God still showed mercy.
God still showed mercy.
Showed his power and glory.
Right. Which brings us to the point of what Messiah gets to in this story, what Messiah is going to in this. Of this story in Elisha, the men being examined, there's more than one, not just Naaman, being examined in the story, who were all of them? Can you name them? The king and the servant Gehazi were definitely being examined. King and Gehazi. Those two are being examined. Are they Israelite? Yes. Not only that, one of them is a very good close servant to Elisha and presumably has participated in miracles of the past. If you recall, Elisha gave him his staff, said, go try to help the boy. It didn't work. Elisha wouldn't have bothered if he knew that Gehazi was worthless and wasn't going to do anything. It wasn't going to be of any value. So Gehazi probably has done some miracles in the past in his service to Elisha up to this point. The king, however, has no caring whatsoever for God. He's, I guess you're not quite atheist, it's just a different religion. He doesn't have any use for God. So the two men who are actually being examined in the story is the king of Israel and Gehazi. Even Naaman is the catalyst or the character going through the story. Who fell short? The king and Gehazi. Who didn't? Naaman. Now, but Naaman was upset. He was angry. He had a bad attitude. Isn't that the problem? No. Right? Naaman's bad attitude. I won't write it up here. Naaman's bad attitude was his anger because he was expecting one thing and got something totally different. He still went. And still did it. He still did it. Now, it took coaxing, but his anger was very clear. He specifically said, I expected this, and I get this instead. Go ahead.
Kind of reminds you of that parable I think Yeshua taught where he says, which son is the more obedient son? The one who is told to do a deed and the son says, yes, I'll do it, and then does not do it? Or the son that initially says, no way, I'm not going to do it, but then turns around and does it? Who is the more obedient son? And that might be what we see here. Who is the more obedient son?
The foreigner. The foreigner.
It would appear another characteristic of Nahum was he was humble enough to hear his servant.
Right.
Not arrogant.
Not arrogant. Yeah, his servant was, I'm sure, humble going up to him. But he is the commander of an army. He has death ability within him. But yeah, you're right. The servant was, he was willing to hear. He wasn't closed ears to input. Yes, Carrie.
Bit of an aside, and I don't want to detract, but there seems to be a common theme, for lack of a better word, some racism of sorts. You know, here's this captain of the host of this nation that has taken Israel captive.
Right.
And he's like, I have to go wash in their filth. And he already thinks they're filthy. So, you know, God's requiring him to basically muck himself up in order for this healing. And at the same time, you've got the king saying, I have to let this guy come into my country for healing? What?
Yeah.
You know, and then Gehazi basically taking advantage.
Took an opportunity. You're right. These are all different characteristics being examined with inside the person. And whose insides were found clean? Naaman's was. Was Gehazi's insides clean? Not at all. The king inside and out was not clean. We discussed him in previous chapters. We'll discuss him again. He's a pretty rotten individual. So he's unclean in every respect. Gehazi's unclean inside. Though on the outward side, as a servant of Elisha, he's a, quote, clean, good Israelite, sons of the prophets kind of person. But the inside, he was really, really worthless. Yes.
The other thing I was thinking about here, because Nahum was well-known, a commander, victorious, goes in, wherever he goes, he gets what he wants, destroys who wants to destroy. And so the king was terrified that this is a trick. I can understand him being just. Because though God was sending him, and the king was terrified. It's kind of like a really odd test that God did with him, but he failed in that sense.
The one thing I want interesting, the king being terrified, it's a separate, I forgot where it is in the Torah, maybe somebody else remembers where it might be. That if you don't obey God, you will be fearful of everything. That one will chase, you know, 100. I forgot the exact terminology. So if you obey God, it'll be the flip reverse. But you're fearful of everything. So the king, now Naaman and his entourage, is inside the city of Samaria. Okay, Samaria has lots of military around. Is Naaman going to say, "Pull your swords, man, let's go kill them all"? The king has nothing to fear from this man who is completely surrounded and has no way of doing anything to, you know, cause any harm. Yet the king's petrified. Is there any reason to be afraid of him? Not at this point, not at all, because he can't do jack. He can't even get out of the city without your permission. So the king, the Naaman is isolated and completely vulnerable, but the king is the one who's afraid. Who's the most invulnerable person there is in the story. He's the one who's petrified. It shows how corrupt an individual is, because the Bible, God instructs us, when your mind goes away from God, you'll be fearful of everything. You'll always be petrified, even though it is nothing to be afraid of. That's an obvious example to look at. So the king is that way. Gehazi, obviously, was not afraid. He obviously went, except of Elisha, he was afraid of. Oh, yes, Anne?
The proverb that says, the wicked flees,
yes.
But there's no one pursuing.
Yeah, Proverbs, that's not too long ago, like 28, I think it is, or Proverbs, something like that.
Does that mean that they're turned over to the demons and they're tortured?
I'm sorry.
Spiritually? Well, you know, it says
your train of thought, I didn't quite catch your train of thought.
I said, if they're running in fear and there's nothing to fear.
Oh, nothing to fear, okay.
So, does that mean they've been turned over to the tormentors?
Is it possible? I think that's a human being issue. Hmm. To me, I could be wrong, but... No. I'm wrong, but the prophecy that's given there in Proverbs, all the lists of prophecies, you read through each one of them, they are very, very, very physical. They are based on human experience and human knowledge. So the proverb given there is a human experience designed for humans to know this is what you will experience as a physical, flesh and blood human being. The entire list of Proverbs is written that way. Now, there are spiritual aspects to all the list of Proverbs as well. But the list specifically given here... to destruction of Satan. Right. That's a separate issue. The Proverbs discussion was a very physical one, which is exactly what the king experienced, a very physical one. Now, don't get wrong, we are spiritual human beings too. I'm not saying that it doesn't apply spiritually as well. My point is that it's written physically for physical people to comprehend and relate to. If a man is a criminal, for example, let's say you're a criminal, whatever crime may make a difference, you're afraid of being caught. What's your natural instinct? Flee. Hide. Hide from who? From everybody, essentially. It's the same thing.
Same thing.
Yeah, it's to flee and to hide, to conceal yourself from not just the police, but somebody else turning you into the police. Somebody else might see, because darkness conceals, light does not. You stay away from the light, you get yourself concealed. You run away, you try to hide, try to conceal yourself. That is a human, children are a great example of what they do when they do something wrong. What do? They run and hide. They run away. That's what we do. The fight or flight issue, that's true too. But that in our experience is to hide and conceal. That's what we do to get ourselves to quote preserve ourselves. So the king's experience is to essentially not quite hide, he can't really hide, but to declare that he is now exposed to the king of Israel, or the king of Syria, to attack, because he's being a pretext. He noticed he's now exposed, even though he actually wasn't yet. It's inside us to do that. So that's the experience that the Proverbs discusses. That's what we're experiencing now in the story. I'm not saying that it isn't also true spiritually. Because it is. Spiritually, it's the exact same story. Because everything on earth is the same as it is in heaven. So if there's a physical example down here, there's a spiritual one as well. What I'm not talking about is I'm not getting into that topic today. The spiritual aspect I'm not discussing today. We're discussing only the physical one today, because that's the objective. That's the example the Messiah gives us. So we have these examples. Who got examined, who fell short, and who didn't. So Messiah's time, I didn't write that. Did I write that down? Oh, verse 19 of both books, the chapters actually. Verse 19 of chapter 17, as well as 2 Kings 5, chapter 9, verse 19, says the same thing essentially. And that both stories say, or do the analysis, sorry, actually verse 20, technically, of 2 Kings, that Gehazi noticed that Aman did not have to pay anything. Naaman didn't have to do anything. That was it. Gehazi didn't like that. This, in Gehazi's viewpoint, he didn't. Gehazi's viewpoint, we're discussing Gehazi right now, so we're moving past the mind, go to Gehazi. Gehazi sees he didn't pay anything. This foreigner isn't required to bring, even Israelites have to bring sacrifices to identify that have been cleaned. This foreigner didn't have to do anything. That's not right. I'm going to go take money from him. He was justifying within himself a evil act to do. Now, in Messiah's case, the man that came back didn't have to pay anything, meaning he didn't have to do a sacrifice as he would normally do. What Messiah say? Go. Go your way. Go away. Go do your thing. Go live your life. What was Naaman given? Go. Live your life. Do your thing. Do what you're going to do. From the outside perspective, you look at it, wait a minute. But that's not right. It is right. It is correct. Because these men did pay something, but not physically. So Gehazi was looking for a physical payment. Because what's Gehazi all about? Appearance. Gehazi is appearance. Not that that's the only thing in the world. The point is that he, from the outside, Gehazi looks good. He looks excellent. Meaning his appearance is great. Meaning he's a servant of Elisha, he knows God, tries to help do miracles, helps the prophets, blah, blah, blah. Lots of good stuff. The outside he's great, on the inside he's not. So Gehazi's appearance is very, very critical. And it appeared to him, this man paid nothing. Yes, Sally?
Only true friends can not pay each other. Because there's a one-upmanship about you submitting yourself to someone and not paying them. Then you're in an owe situation.
Right.
And most people are not willing to do that to someone unless they're really close. It would have been very distressful for Naaman not to pay his bill because that submits him. And Gehazi, well, you wouldn't want to let him feel bad.
Naturally. Gehazi, well, it was all about Naaman's personal feelings, of course. So Gehazi noticed that from the appearance side, it cost Naaman nothing. Now, in reality, it cost him an awful lot. But Gehazi didn't recognize what it cost him. In the man of Messiah's time, it cost him, from the appearance side, nothing. But it actually cost him a lot, too. The man of Messiah's time recognized there's a high priest change. I'm a foreigner, and I recognize that the priest of Israel is of no value to me. That this one is. So this foreigner who is Samaritan, who has been taught his whole life he has to bow down the priest of Israel, is now realizing in his own head, no. That's not always so easy to do. Yes, Ellie?
That's why he had to say thank you.
Right. Naaman did the exact same thing. He had to humble himself very low. And it wasn't through funds. He didn't pay his way out of it. He didn't, as I tried to point out, it wasn't the, hey, I'm paying you for your services type of attitude. It wasn't done that way because that would justify the exchange. It was, I have to bring myself down lower than I've ever been to essentially worship or bow to an individual and to a God whom I have never known. And realizing that the, quote, God of Vermont, or priest in case of a Samaritan, is of no value to me anymore. Notice the differences? As far as what's being paid? It wasn't an exchange of land or money or animals. It was an exchange of belief system within inside the person. That's not, it's hard. It's not that easy to change that. It takes a lot of work. So that's what these men gave. That was their payment. That was what God wanted. Because what does God want? A broken and contrite spirit and heart, not money and animals. That's pretty simple.
He owns it all.
He owns all. It's all his stuff. And the foreigners got it. The non-Israelites understood. The Israelites didn't. They didn't get it. So do you understand why the example is given to us here in 2 Kings? When Messiah comes up and hit on the scene and does the exact same thing, we would recognize it's not about the payment. It's not about the stuff. It's not about the doing by the books. It's about recognizing what is important and what isn't. It's what's on the inside, Mr. Gehazi, not on the outside. It's a very simple imagery, a simple story. But it's all for us to understand and use. Because God's not looking on the outside, Mr. Gehazi. He's looking at what's inside. As the king was afraid of, there's a foreigner coming now. He's going to kill me. Even though I have a bigger hand, I'm stronger, and I have him surrounded, I'm going to be the one who loses. The king was petrified because there was nothing inside that was good of him. Gehazi showed there's nothing inside that was good of him either. It just finally in the story gets exposed that everyone now can see what was on the inside of Gehazi is now on the outside. Disease. Any questions or comments? Yes, Sean.
I'm having a block here. Maybe it's just old traditions that's within me, but I've always been taught your attitude is not correct and your approach, you know, to God.
Speak up a little louder.
If your attitude and approaching God, you know, for healing or whatever, you know, if it's stinky, just forget it. You know, but yet this guy's attitude stinks.
Examine the two different examples given to us with Naaman's attitude approaching God compared to, for example, the men followed Ahaziah who came to go get Elijah off the mountaintop. There were multiple examples of the men, the commanders of 50, they did it three times. They went up to Elijah at the mountaintop. They had completely different objectives in their approach to the man of God. Naaman's approach was, I need something. And I thought I was going to get this, but in fact got that. I still have a belief in a God of some form. I will follow, though I don't like it. The initial response was, I don't like it. I'll follow it anyway. The commanders who came to approach Elijah, they came for a different objective. It was all about what they're going to do to obey someone else, to obey their king, to do to the man of God, to approach him not a I need your help, but rather you will obey me approach. So it's a difference of attitude and what you do. The words that come out of your mouth are important, but what you do is also important too. And that when you need something, what do you go to? You go to God. You pray for it. If you say, God, you're going to go do X, Y, Z, because that's what you read says you must have happen. Is God going to go do X, Y, Z? Of course not. So that cries cross out ahead. I'm not going to listen to you. That's the response you get. There are different ways which these men approach God. Yes, Jeff.
Well, I mean, to answer Sean's question there, his attitude might have been bad, but the difference was is when he first got into the water and went down one time and finally on the seventh time, that's a change. Just getting in the water, going to the river, actually getting in the water, then actually going down and washing seven times. That, you know, his attitude may have stunk before that time, but and it really illustrates what Messiah said to him. He said, you know, kind of told the parable. It's just like, you know, there's, well, which one is better? You know, one that says, I'm going to go do it, and then doesn't do it. Or the one says, I will not do it, and then changes his mind later and then does it. Which one has actually done the will?
Right.
The second one. Right. Even though initially he had a really, you know, crappy attitude.
Yes, Carrie.
And not to take away from that at all, but just something I was thinking is Naaman's, his response was honest. He never had the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in his life before that we know of. He somehow got abreast of how stuff was supposed to work, and then it didn't work that way. He had no way of knowing that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob would maybe do something different than what he was expecting. His response was honest. The king is the king of Israel. He's got all of their annals. He's got all of their records. He has absolutely no reason to not believe in the God of his country who rescued his nation. And he chooses to live in fear anyway. And Gehazi works for this great prophet who's renowned throughout the land because of how he serves God. And he falls to this ulterior motive. Naaman was the only one who was really honest and had a reason to even behave the way he did.
Yes, Tammy.
You know, because, you know, in a way it's like, you know, Naaman, I think, in some ways almost felt insulted initially that Elisha's request was not some gargantuan, difficult task. Here he is the commander of armies. How many men has he trained to be soldiers? How many men has he killed in the heat of battle and then survived? And yet he's being told to take a bath.
Even that by a servant, that not even by the man himself.
Yes. And yet somehow he overcame that initial shock of the request and went through with it.
For those of you who've experienced God working with your lives over the years, I'm sure many of you have, for various things in your time, when God requires you, it says, not obviously verbally, but encourage you, you have this instruction, I have to go do what? You want me to go do what? And you're shocked. I don't want to do that. How many of you have experienced that? I don't want to do that. That's humiliating. That's awful. That's embarrassing. I can't do that. That's too much, God. How many of us have thought that in our minds? When you first experience it, at any point in time in your life, most of you will, if you haven't yet, just give yourself time, that God will tell you to go do something, and you're too embarrassed, too ashamed, and angry because of it. That's a normal reaction. What matters then is what are you going to go do now? What is your path? What is it that you're actually going to do? Just because you got shocked. Now note, those of you who are not aware of this, most of us do not comprehend God's thinking. So when we have something in our minds, we want it to go this way, and God says, no, it's going this way over here instead. We are like, but God, I thought, I don't want to do that. I thought it was this. This is what you should do. And does God say, oh, I'm terribly sorry. You're absolutely right. I apologize for making a mistake. I will allow it to go your way. To be shocked at the unexpected result is okay. As long as you say, okay, I'll do the unexpected now and walk through it. That's okay. That's fine. That's not the problem. To be shocked and say, absolutely not, and then continue on your path, that's what I think, as you're pointing out earlier, Sean, was the question, the issue of attitude. Wait a minute. If you say, I'm not going to do this, I'm going to headlong into the brick wall at 90 miles an hour, because that's what I want to go do. And you go do it, and guess what happens? Not so good things. It's the actual action of saying, but God, I like the brick wall. And God says, you're not going to like it when you get there. And you say, but, okay, fine. I'll turn around. It's the action that God weighs. He's a God of actions, not a God of just words. So the bad attitude that Naaman had was a bad attitude, but his actions outweighed it. He turned his actions around and followed the path anyway. That was the hard thing. That's what people don't like to do. Does it make sense? Have a good rest of your Shabbat. Thank you for your time.